At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. Whether your pursuit involves a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree, GCU's learning environments are designed for supportive networking and collaboration. With over 330 academic programs, GCU provides a path to help you fulfill your dreams. The pursuit to serve others is yours. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey everybody, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I am Ben Boland. Scott, is that listener mail you were holding?
I do have a piece of listener mail. Usually we wait till the end, but sure. Today we've got another listener suggestion that I think we're going to follow up with in the form of a podcast.
You know we love playing requests.
Very exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, what's going on?
This is one from Chad from Kansas.
Do you mean Roadkill?
I mean Chad Roadkill... last name that we're not going to read, from Kansas. That's right. And, Chad wrote in and said that, he said, I would not call myself a car enthusiast, but they are the next best thing to what I love. I love motorcycles.
Ah.
I eat, sleep, and breathe motorcycles.
That sounds difficult, but.
Well, yeah, it sounds a little rough on the lungs. That being said, I was listening to the podcast about whiskey cars, and you guys asked for suggestions, for books that we might enjoy. And he mentions a book. He mentions a book called Outlaw Machine by Brock Yates.
Ooh,
and
okay.
It's a history of the culture of Harley-Davidson and the image associated with the motorcycle. You might know the name Brock Yates. He was the editor of Car and Driver for a long time. Also an author. He's got several books out there, but Outlaw Machine is one that Chad recommends. So we'll have to look at that. And then Chad says, after listening to your podcast on Toyota, I thought that maybe you could do one on the history of Harley-Davidson. It's interesting to hear specifically about the customization of Harleys and the fact that you rarely see two Harleys that are the same, and almost none of the bikes are completely stock. Just says he loves the variety and looking forward to listening to many more podcasts. So, Chad, I guess we're going to talk about Harley-Davidson history today.
Yeah, we hope you like this one. We've got a couple of articles on this, too, since we are a website as well.
La-dee-da.
Now, everybody knows the name Harley-Davidson. I don't care if you like motorcycles or not.
Yeah, I think everybody's heard this.
This is something you see them if we did an iconic – motorcycles from TV and film thing, a lot of them would be Harleys.
Mm-hmm.
Almost the majority. They're parts of classic American culture. You got Easy Rider.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's a great one.
Yeah, that's a very good one.
Mm-hmm.
Probably. Well, that's actually the that's a chopper, right?
Yeah,
that is it's a Harley Davidson powered chopper, and that's really cool too because that's kind of like the birth of the chopper breed. A lot of the styling cues from that vehicle went into what everybody thinks of, you know, like the ape hanger bars.
Yeah.
And, the front end goes way out, but it's a cool looking bike.
Mm-hmm. Now, what we're going to try to answer for you here, Roadkill, is, what exactly led up to these awesome bikes we're seeing today? Well, we get our start with two gentlemen, William S. Harley and his buddy Arthur Davidson.
Mm-hmm. And they lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And this is going all the way back, Ben, to the 1880s. So this goes back probably farther than most people would think, but it goes way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And like I mentioned, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which is very important now because that's where their corporate headquarters are found.
Right.
What happened was these guys, they worked at a local manufacturing plant, the both of them did, and they decided together that they were going to do something kind of new, it's new at the time, not, mm-hmm. not original.
No.
Other people were doing this as well, but they decided they were going to develop an engine, an air-cooled engine that they could put on a bicycle. So, you know, they're going to take this relatively new technology of internal combustion engines.
Yeah.
And they were going to apply it to a bicycle frame.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for power.
Right. And so you might say that this is more of a motorcycle. Right?
Yeah, than
a bicycle.
Sure.
Bicycle. Sure. This idea, the reason that we're taking some steps to make sure that we don't say they're the first and only people who had ever tried to attempt this before is that there were already people building motorcycles in Europe.
Yes.
But not, there are people in the States, sure, but they're not near, as history will prove and as we will show you over this podcast, they weren't as successful.
No, not as successful. That's right. And, it wasn't long, after they developed this, now this is an air-cooled engine, real small engine,
yeah.
Not anything big at all. I mean, it's really, really tiny. They find out that it just doesn't have enough power, to propel the bike like they thought it would.
Right.
Like it's a nice assist.
Yeah, it can maybe – yeah, it's a nice assist. But if you're talking about power going up an incline or going up a hill, you know, or something like that with the weight of passenger.
Sure. You're still relying on your foot pedal power.
Yeah. It's more like a hybrid
than
a motorcycle.
That's right. Yeah. So it had very little power, this first motorcycle mm-hmm. First bicycle powered by a motor that they produced, right? That they built kind of on their own, an oddity, I guess, a one-off. By 1902, they had designed, you know, of course they brought in Arthur's brother at this point.
Yes.
This is a little bit earlier. Arthur's brother actually helped with that first engine.
That'd be Walter Davidson.
Walter Davidson, that's right. And he was a machinist. So they figured he's the guy to talk to, you know, to get this thing not really going. Well, by 1902, they had already started work on their second engine. And they kind of recruited another guy, another mechanic, to get more power out of this. You know who this was, Ben? You know?
Was this?
Go ahead.
No, you do it.
Ollie Evinrud.
And who is Ollie Evinrud?
Have you ever heard of Evinrud Boats? Evinrud Motors? This is the guy. This is amazing the way these two came together at this time in history.
Mm-hmm.
Later in his career, this guy is the one that would found Evinrud Boats, Evinrud Motors, Evinrud Outdoor Power Sport. I don't know what it was exactly.
But now he's just an ordinary engine building Joe Average.
Yeah, he's just another mechanic that's out there, but he lives in Wisconsin. I think he lives in Cambridge, Wisconsin. He is a Norwegian American. But he's later credited with inventing the first outboard boat motor.
Mm.
So, you know, there's Evinrud, deep history there as well.
Yeah.
But anyways, they get together. He gets together with the Harley and Davidson brothers,
mm-hmm.
and they build another motor that has 3 horsepower. Ben,
woo!
Three horsepower. Thanks for the sound effect.
Kick the tires and light the fires, big guy.
Yeah, 3 horsepower. So this is 1902. They're building a 3 horsepower power assisted bicycle at the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. By which we mean when we're saying that, we mean that. For someone to start the motor, they're like pedaling the bike to get it up to a speed.
Exactly, that it'll continue to run.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, it's still pretty small, you know, manufacturing facility here, I would say, because if you go online, you can find some shots of the original workshop that they worked in beginning in 1903. And this is one of the things that you'll stumble across pretty easily, I think, if you search for it. But by 1903, you know, these guys are starting to build these single cylinder motors in this wooden shed that their father built, that William C. Davidson built.
Right.
And it's just a tiny little place. It's 10 feet by 15 feet. And it's got, you know, handwritten on the door, the Harley Davidson Motor Company. Really tiny. It looks like it has four windows and maybe a furnace of some kind inside because of the smokestack.
And in the context of the time, this is – now let's remember the time period. This is not the time period of gigantic manufacturing plants. I mean, it's not uncommon for someone to have like a cottage industry level manufacturing.
Exactly what I was going to say. This is a cottage level industry – right on the nose. I mean, this is exactly what it's all about. They've got a father who is a cabinet maker, builds them this, it's basically a shed, 10 by 15, and that's where they started their business. And by 1903, they only sold, three motorcycles. They sold three, they manufactured three motorcycles that year.
One for each horsepower?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. And then in 1904, again, three motorcycles. Mm-hmm. So, very, very limited production in those first couple of years.
Here's the thing. That's how many they sold in 1904, but they made eight.
Oh, did they really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
They were trying to get – well, I think we see a small production number for them for most of the years. Eventually, let's see, in 19 – but there's a big growth here.
It jumps quick.
Yeah. In 1905, they made 16.
Yeah.
So they doubled.
You know, it's interesting about the 1905 motorcycle.
What's that?
I got a little note here about this, and this one really struck me. Their 1905 model was called the Silent Gray Fellow, and it was known to be extremely reliable and had a gray color, of course, but it was known for its quiet operation.
Now, which is so weird.
Can you imagine known for its quiet operation, this is a Harley Davidson.
We're gonna talk about that Harley noise too.
Yes.
Don't worry about that, guys.
Oh,
we're
gonna
get to that one. But it's so strange. The Silent Gray Fellow.
Yeah, and here it is. It's a 450cc single cylinder bike again.
Okay.
Still using a bicycle style frame. So they haven't yet made a specific motorcycle frame for this thing.
Right.
But it says to slow or stop, the rider had to pedal backwards in order to make it, to make it do that. Mm-hmm. So you're fighting the momentum of the motor at that point, the momentum of the whole bike. But anyways, I thought that was really, really strange that it was named for its silent operation.
And Scott, these, Silent Gray Fellows are pretty successful because by 1906, Harley Davidson is building 50 bikes a year.
Awesome.
And now we're going to go to one of what I think is the coolest things, 1907, there's a little motorcycle show, right?
Yeah.
And, so the Harley Davidson brothers, the HD crew, as I'll call them, decide to show off their answer to the problem with their single cylinder.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I'm talking about?
Sure.
They're talking about the V-twin motor.
Exactly.
Which, let's be honest, this changes the game.
This is revolutionary for them. This is what turned it around for Harley Davidson, really.
Mm-hmm.
This is what led them into some big time sales.
Yeah.
Led them into, really becoming a household name for a while. I mean,
fixed that pedal problem too.
that's exactly right. Yeah. So they've got this V-twin motor, which is really, I mean, even today, this is iconic. This is the 45-degree angle twin cylinder motor that's really become kind of what you. It's synonymous with the name Harley Davidson.
I think that's fair.
Point.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's what gives that's part of what gives Harley that distinctive sound. It's part of that whole mix. We'll talk about that too.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
1907 was really kind of a watershed year because you mentioned in 1906 they sold 50 bikes.
Right.
Do you know – you'd probably know the number for 1907, right?
Do I have – what is the 1907 number, Scott?
I don't know about the number exactly, specific number.
Yeah.
But Arthur, who was apparently a great salesman – he could sell anything apparently,
yeah.
Arthur Davidson.
Nice.
He signed up over 800 dealers in 10 years based on this design starting in 1907. So 800 dealers in 10 years. So, now they're all across the United States in, you know, the lower 48 at the time. And, so this is, 5 years after the first Harley? They've got the Detroit police that bought an entire fleet of motorcycles.
Goodness.
And by 1925, there were more than 2,500 police units in the United States that were riding Harley Davidson motorcycles. So these became the street cruisers of choice.
Right.
For law enforcement.
And it's no surprise, really, because if you think about it, if you're law enforcement, especially if you're in a city of some sort, mm-hmm. a motorcycle would be invaluable.
Oh, definitely. Even at the time. I mean, there was mm-hmm. still light traffic. There wasn't really – it wasn't mm-hmm. nearly as crowded as it is now. But still, maneuverability, just mm-hmm. – I mean, everything about it made sense for a patrolling officer to have a motorcycle on the streets at certain mm-hmm. times of the year, depending on the climate and, things like that. But mm-hmm. Very dependable machine. Able to carry all the gear that they needed to at the time. Mm-hmm. And to this day, still used by a lot of law enforcement agencies on the road.
So our Harley guys, Harley Davidson brothers, seem pretty well set up, don't they, Scott?
Yes, they do.
They've got the world ahead of them in maybe 5 years, five odd years. They've really started to make a name for themselves and make some serious change.
Sure. I think it's safe to say that they've moved out of the shed at this point.
And we both know Murphy's Law, so we know what happens every time something is going relatively well for everybody. Something unexpected, there's a plot twist. In their case, it is World War I.
Ah, but you know what? Didn't work out so bad for the Harley brothers.
No.
The Harley Davidson brothers.
Yes, Harley Davidson.
That's the better way to say it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because, oddly enough, and this was kind of unheard of until this point, of mm-hmm. course, they were able to provide motorcycles to the military for use in World War I.
Yes.
And I don't know why I hadn't thought of this, but I was thinking for some reason that World War II was kind of the first war that Harley had been
– That kind of partnership?
Yeah, exactly. I guess maybe it's because of the auto industry shutting down and everything that went along with that. But World War I – Yeah, they were in production long before World War I.
Yeah.
So, this seems to make a good fit that they've got soldiers and, infantrymen that are able to patrol on these bikes. And, didn't they say that one of the first riders into the war, into Germany was on a Harley Davidson?
On a Harley bike. Yeah,
exactly. They even mentioned the soldier here somewhere. Roy Holtz.
Yes.
Was the first American GI to enter Germany, and he was on a Harley Davidson.
And it's no wonder too, because at this time also we gotta consider like Harley Davidson's success, a lot of it is based on this engine, really. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it is also based on the salesmanship abilities of Arthur. Mm-hmm. But let's not act like this is all just an engine and a good salesman, because they also have technological innovations on the way. Like they invent one of the first clutches for this stuff in 1912.
Interesting.
And then they've also got they start working with chain drives in 1914. They've got a two-speed rear hub. So and then they move up. By 1915, they actually hit proper three-speed transmissions.
Yeah, do you know how efficient these things were too? Extremely efficient. Their first – and I've got to mention this because their first notable success was in the early 1900s. It was 1908 where Walter Davidson rode in the Jack Pine Endurance Run.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And the bike was – of course, it was reliable. But it won an economy contest getting 188 miles per gallon.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Yeah, that's incredible, isn't
it? As someone who drives a Monte Carlo, that could change my life, Scott.
It's unbelievable. 188 miles per gallon in 1908 is what this thing was getting.
Yeah.
So, and now, they were fast. They were mm-hmm. efficient mm-hmm. Because at the time they were also setting speed records, like on board tracks, on sand in mm-hmm. Daytona.
Yeah.
They had all kinds of speed records that they were winning as well. So they're getting into racing at this point. And this is an important part of their history, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I see it as that. I mean, maybe it's just a footnote, really, but it's carried on through today.
It's not a footnote. It's part of the story.
What's a nickname for Harley Davidson?
It is a hog.
That's right. And do you know why it's called hog? You probably do, but.
Oh, what? No, actually, I don't know why it's called a hog.
You really don't? Okay.
You really
is
don't.
A, the term hog, comes from, back in the early 1920s.
Scott has some notes here with – I could see that. Does that say the term hog? It says the first hog.
The first hog, and there's a picture of a Harley Davidson. You know what? This is another thing. I'm going to get off on a little bit of a tangent here.
Let's go, man. I love tangents.
Take a look at some of these Harley Davidson riders from the Harley Davidson team that raced in the early 1920s, 1930s.
Yeah.
They've got those – it's almost like a really tight sweater that has knitted into it Harley Davidson on the front and, like a leather cap and
nice.
Goggles and everything and the gloves, usually wearing a long sleeve t-shirt beneath it or something.
Mm-hmm.
these guys are covered with grime and grit, and they're on those really cool-looking old bikes. It's just a neat scene. And they've got, you know, the trousers that are pushed into their socks, you know, with the tall boots and everything. It's really kind of a cool-looking, racing – I hate to say outfit, but
– Well, moment suit, in racing
– Racing suit.
Yeah, okay.
That's a better
That's
way to say
a little
that.
Better,
yeah. And this photo that I'm looking at here – There's a guy in one of those outfits, and he's, of course, covered with road grime and everything, and people are standing around him smiling, but he's got a pig in his arms, kind of like you'd hold, let's just say a wiener dog.
Okay.
Like you'd hold a wiener dog under your arm like a football almost.
Yeah.
It looks like he's giving it a drink of beer. And
finally.
There's got to be a story to this, right?
Yeah.
So here's this this hog association, as according to the company archives. In the 1920s, the official racing team name was the Wrecking Crew, the Harley-Davidson Wrecking Crew.
Sounds cool. Pessimistic,
yeah,
but
pretty
cool.
Pretty cool, yeah. And so they had, you know, they dominated the dirt track races that they entered.
Yeah.
But they brought on this non-racer, which is a small pig. Kind of a little mascot that they would keep with them at the track, right? And I don't know why they did that, but for whatever reason they did. And whenever a Harley-Davidson team member would win a race, he would pick up this little pig that they had on the sideline, a small little pig, and carry it around with him on the victory lap. And it became this kind of thing that they always did after every victory lap, right? And, of course, they're winning a lot of races.
Right, yeah.
People are noticing this. Of course, it happens all over the place. And the media starts to call them the Harley Hogs. Now, the Harley Hogs, you know – the Wrecking Crew kind of stuck around. Harley Hogs stuck around, and then eventually the Wrecking Crew went away, and the Harley Hogs developed, kind of morphed into just the Hogs.
Wow! And that's how it happens.
Exactly, that's how it happens. So there's a lot of really cool photos of these racers holding
a thoroughly confused pig,
a pig that is, you know, looks like it's partaking of some beer here, but some victory beer, but. Yeah, that's where it came from. There's some funny photos, so check it out.
And pigs are smart, dude. I bet you that pig knew what was going on.
Oh, probably. Yeah, he's milking this for all it's worth.
So here we are now. We've weathered. We're Harley Davidson Company. We've weathered a world war.
Mm-hmm.
We've really got our chops racing.
Mm-hmm.
Our pork chops. I'm sorry.
Yeah, very good.
There's nothing that'll make up for that. I apologize to the listeners. And now we start getting into some more of their – let's do – do you want to do like their post-war years?
Well, you know what? During the war
– Okay.
I mean they joined the war – of course, America joined the war in 1941. And again
– yes.
Again. I mean Harley was right there. So they were able to produce motorcycles. They devoted all of their output to the military from 1941 all the way through 1945.
Which was not uncommon.
No. And this is a lot. Of motorcycles. Mm. We're talking about 88,000 models for the U.S. military, and they built about 20,000 for the Canadians. So more than 100,000 bikes were built during that period strictly for military purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And they had pretty much stopped – or they had stopped – I don't know if it's completely stopped or just, you know, somewhat stopped production for, you know, just citizens.
Well, they, you know, here's something interesting, and I'm glad you mentioned this because I want to talk about it. It seems maybe a little weird to people, but it makes complete sense just because when you're manufacturing vehicles like this, there is a bit of a zero sum equation.
Mm-hmm.
You can only make so many per year, and demand, especially if you have a contract with the U.S. government mm-hmm. in the middle of a world war. You just can't make as many bikes.
Sure, yeah. You do what you have to do, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they were able to make, like I said, 88,000 for the U.S., 20,000 for the Canadians. Mm-hmm. Now by the time the war ended,
mm-hmm.
You know, all these servicemen come back, and the problem is that, you know, the civilian production had stopped. So
right.
there really are no new Harleys around from, you know, prior to 1940.
Yeah,
and these guys are, you know, kind of. A lot of them are used to having Harley around. You know, they had them in service,
mm-hmm.
and they want one again, so they're able to buy Army surplus motorcycles, and there's lots of them to be had. And
yes.
Kind of interesting because I think that's, you know, some bikes that a lot of people would like to have these days, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But there's still a bunch of them out there. And a lot of them started you know, this is the kind of a new trend at the time. You know how hot riding was kind of new at the time?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what they started doing with their motorcycles. They started hot riding these motorcycles mm-hmm. and modifying them and, you know, shortening the fenders and, you know, beginning to get into this kind of chopper mm-hmm. Breed of motorcycles that, you know, a lot of people to this day love.
Yes, absolutely. And they've got a oh, let's see where we want to go. Scott, I've got to apologize. As we're talking, I'm going through my notes mm-hmm. and I'm trying to, just for listeners who, like our show enough to listen regularly have probably realized that, you and I leave the booth at HSW headquarters every time we do a podcast. Mm-hmm. One of us might not even get out of the room before we realize we missed something.
Oh, usually I read the email address and then I slap my forehead.
That is what usually happens.
I really do, saying I've forgotten something important. So, you know, watch for that along the way, but I'm sure it'll happen. But, we're trying to hit everything that we can here without going too deep.
Can I do a sidebar?
Yeah, please.
So by this point, where are we? We're post-war years.
Sure.
So we're post-World War II. By this point, we start to see, a 180 from the idea of the silent gray fellow.
Yes.
This is where we start to really get into that distinctive noise, which hopefully I'm not going to embarrass myself trying to impersonate it. So I'm going to pause in hopes that our producers will throw one in. Okay, so hopefully that
was either dead air or a motorcycle sound.
Yes. Please fill in the blank for yourself. So what is it, Scott? What's the deal with that angry lion?
Well, like we mentioned, it comes from that V-twin 45-degree angle, engine that they've kind of developed on their own way back in history, back in 1909.
Yeah.
But the thing is, recently it's not all that unique. And, you know, a lot of other manufacturers are doing the same kind of thing and they get a very similar sound from it.
Right.
Here's kind of a little side note on this. If you want, this is kind of a myth that's been thrown around.
Mm-hmm.
I think your smile shows me that you know what I'm talking about here. Have you ever heard that the Harley-Davidson sound is a registered trademark?
I have heard that.
Okay. You know that it's, I'm just going to tell you, it's not really true.
I've heard it, but it isn't true.
It isn't true. With this note, they did try. They did try to register the trademark Harley-Davidson or the Harley-Davidson sound as a trademark. And unfortunately, it just didn't work out for them. This goes back to 1994. Hmm. And, you know, there's that distinct Harley-Davidson exhaust sound that we all know the sound. We've heard it in traffic. You've heard it on the road, mm-hmm. wherever. So it's a V-twin engine. It's got this common crank pin.
Mm-hmm. So for everybody listening, it's two pistons, but it has one pin.
That's right. Yeah. So, you know, it's got this kind of interesting, at the time, unique motor.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we'll find out soon that it's not so unique, but.
Right.
Anyways, they tried to get the sound trademarked. You know, they made several recordings and said, this is what it sounds like. And, you know, they had the whole full legal description of what it sounds like.
And here's a mechanical illustration of why it sounds this way.
Exactly. Yeah. And here's how we do it.
Mm.
And the problem was that they got a lot of competitors were arguing that they use the same type of engine. And really, it produces the same type of sound. So in order to trademark that, it would be very, very difficult to say that, you know, this is our sound. You can't make this sound anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's impossible, but they put up enough of a fuss that it went on for about 6 years, Ben, this argument.
Wow.
And
even when they knew they couldn't get it.
Yeah, I knew. And it looked like there's going to be just no end in sight to this very costly litigation that happens with something like this. And, you know, the competitors were going to fight it right to the very end. So Harley eventually in the year 2000 just withdrew the request for the trademark. And, it's not a trademark sound. So that's putting that rumor to bed.
But, I've got a pretty cool sidebar really briefly about why that noise happens.
Oh, great.
And here's how it works. So we've got the Harley engine, as my astute co-host has said, two pistons, one pin. And so usually a piston is firing like, every revolution of the pin, right?
Mm-hmm.
360 degrees. So in a Harley engine, what happens is the first piston fires and then the next one fires at 315 degrees.
Hmm.
And after that, there's a gap, 405 degrees. Weird, right? Because it's more in a circle.
Okay.
And then a piston fires again, and then the next piston fires. And that's why there's that weird pop, pop.
Because it's a very irregular sound.
It sounds like that because of the way the pin and the piston rods are working together.
Interesting. So it's a loping sound.
Yeah. That's a great description, Scott. So that's the unique sound of the motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just saying that because, you know, it's one of those things that you always wonder about when you hear a hog.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you've got to wonder if they just had aggressive marketing that made them say, oh, it's unique, or if there was a mechanical reason. And that is the reason.
Hmm. So there is a mechanical reason for that sound. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
I can
understand then why they would want to trademark that sound at that point. I can see that.
We're on the edge of something very important, Scott, if you're talking about 2000.
Let's hear it.
Are we going? To the next year? We've got some more stuff to do,
How about this? Hey, let's do a short little bit here, and then you can bring it up to date.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
We're talking about just post-war, and I'll make this quick, I promise.
But, take your time, man.
There's this onslaught of cheaper competition. And when I say cheaper, I mean a little more inexpensive.
Right.
Because imports, this is where you're getting, you know, some of the British imports, the Japanese imports, and it was such a tough time for them to try to compete in this world, you know, with lots of competition, which they didn't have before.
Yeah. I can't believe I almost forgot this part.
Yeah. They were purchased by American Machine and Foundry, which is AMF, in 1969.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look back at some of the Harley logos, you'll see AMF.
Pasted,
you know,
on there,
of course, yeah. And, you know, you notice, again, that's another kind of interesting thing. Look at the Harley logos through history because they change often.
Yes.
And there's some really cool ones, and there's some that, you know, so-so. But they're back to getting some really cool ones, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So they went through these really, really difficult times. And then by about 1981, that's when the senior management of Harley-Davidson bought the company back from AMF, and then it was strictly Harley from that point on.
Right, yeah, because when Harley is able to sort of buy its own freedom, I guess you could look at it this way. We have to understand during the 70s, during this period of time, that Harley's reputation suffered to the point where one of my a good friend of mine named Ron is a biker, and he's retired now, which means he bikes all of the time, like cross country. And he was one of the first guys who told me when I was little, he told me about his Harley that he owned. And this is, you know, I'm a kid at the time. He's a lot older than me, and he's like, I got this Harley. It's from before you were born. And I was like, oh, wow, that's so cool. What an awesome bike. He's like, no, this isn't an awesome bike, Ben. It was from 1974. He's like, that's when you had to buy two Harleys. And, you know, if you're a bike rider, you know the joke. People used to say you got to buy two Harleys, one to keep on the road and one for spare parts.
Yeah, so he would, he'd want one prior to that or after that then.
He told, it was a really weird conversation. That's what you want. The one, the prior one or the one after that period, because when Harley did not own itself, a lot of the bikers, a lot of the fans of Harley-Davidson really felt that the quality of the bike decreased.
So from 69 till 81, there was a bit of an issue with quality.
Now you'll hear people saying that.
Yeah, that's a dispute. I mean, you can argue that either way, I suppose.
Right. I've never ridden a Harley from that time. I didn't get to ride the bike he was complaining about, but that is something that I've heard.
Have you ever ridden a Harley?
I have, yeah. I have been riding on one. I have not driven it.
Ah, that's okay. Yeah, I haven't.
You haven't?
No, I've just been around them. I like the way they sound, and they look awful heavy.
They're so cool, man. It's addictive. Our guest producer today, Tyler, is actually working for the enemy because he is an avid motorcycle enthusiast, and he owns a Triumph.
Yeah, very cool bike, though.
Very cool bike.
Yeah.
Very cool bike.
Very cool bike.
I don't want to get us off subject.
Nope. So now we're back in the 1980s.
Back in the 80s.
And
Harley has bought its freedom.
Yep. So it's still, you know, it's still got its name. You know, it's got its Harley-Davidson name, and everybody recognizes it.
Yeah.
But it's coming back on strong. And by about 1983, you know, they're starting to form these groups that, you know, have a lot of different members. Like 30,000 members, I think, in the first year is what they said. The Harley Owners Group, which HOG, Harley Owners Group, HOG.
Do you get it?
Yeah. So, and I think now, there's a million plus, something like that. There's way over a million people. And, you know, it was a good move on senior management's part to purchase that back from AMF and try to restore the name.
Absolutely.
Because it really led to kind of a rebirth of the company.
Yes. And when we're talking about that membership and the fans, of course, we know we're not talking about – we haven't mentioned the biker gangs, guys. It's not because we don't want to. It's just because we've got so much on this one.
It's another podcast.
It's a story for another day.
That's right. You know what? We have an article on the Hells Angels.
Yes, we do. We do. I was looking at it earlier today, actually.
You know, can I mention one thing that I have to mention?
Five.
I feel like I have to. I'm a kid. I was born in early 70s.
Yeah.
And I grew up watching Evel Knievel on television.
Oh, yeah.
Evel Knievel's bike was a Harley Davidson. At a certain point. You know, before that, I think he was on an import as well. But he did have a Harley Davidson. He had a 1972 Harley Davidson XR750. You know where that bike is now?
I would imagine it's in a museum.
The Smithsonian. It's in the Smithsonian. So that's a big-time deal to have it in the Smithsonian collection, I think. But it was chosen by him, because – and this is funny when you look at it. He chose it because it was lightweight – and dependable. Well, now lightweight is where I chuckle. I mean, dependable. I understand. You know,
right.
Of course, you want a dependable bike, but it was about a 300-pound bike. That's kind of a big bike. And when you look at it, it doesn't look like a sport bike like today.
No,
it's pretty lean looking. But again, 300-pound Harley Davidson bike. I mean, it just doesn't seem like something I would try to want. You know,
to jump 16 buses with?
I don't know. Let's say Caesar's Palace fountains.
There we go.
Something like that.
Yeah.
You know, interesting the way he was thinking back, or way everybody was thinking back then. I mean, it's just so big.
Now, what do you, where are we? Are we in year 2000 yet? Are we building up?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do that.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
No, give me, I know you got two more things.
No, I'm done.
All right. Well, we can go back, but I'm sorry, because this is my kid in the candy store moment. Mm-hmm. And we go from the year 2000 to 2001, and we have a unorthodox move. A move by Harley Davidson that some would call revolutionary.
Okay. All right.
I'm talking about the Revolution engine, which comes out in 2001. Different. The V-twin we've talked about, there's a huge list of different types of engine designs that Harley has had from knucklehead, shovelhead, all the way up. You know, the twin cam 88, that's a good one. The Revolution engine, however, is different because it is water cooled instead of air cooled. And instead of that iconic 45 degree angle, they went to 60.
Why?
It has four overhead cams rather than two in the crankcase.
Mm-hmm.
It's also fuel injected.
Mm-hmm.
And it also is a little bit smaller.
Okay.
But as to why, That would kind of be conjecture. I don't know. They, man.
Yeah, just moving on. That's all.
I guess that's what it is.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, you try different things, you see how they work.
Right. Fair enough. And it could just be another step in their stuff. But, you know, a lot of Harley riders are rather traditional about that, which is, you know, one of the big things about Harleys when Roadkill was talking to us about the customization, you know, that kind of retro styling, that kind of road dog look, you know,
road dog. I like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's a very specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, as a result, you know, changes with that are, risky.
Yeah, so. I can imagine that. I mean, it's slow to catch on, I think would be a way to say it. And not always.
Not always.
Sometimes they love it, but sometimes it's slow to catch on. Hey, one other quick thing before we wrap it up here, because I think I'm just about done. How about you?
I could go on, but I won't. I won't.
Yeah, I've got a 20-page timeline here that if you went through every item, good grief. It goes from 1900, you know, well, 1880s all the way through today. But,
we'd be Harley stuff.
Honestly, if... Probably the last thing that I want to mention here is that you can go on a Harley Davidson factory tour.
Yes, which
is really cool because, you know, not many places will do this where they actually take you to the factory where they are still producing the production models.
You can see how the sausage is made, so to speak.
Oh boy,
I've been.
Bad.
That impression, yeah. It's a mixed, it's a mixed comparison. Not my best moment. But yeah, that's what people
gross.
See.
Gross, yeah. Most people don't want to see that. I would want to see a Harley Davidson being built, though. So,
sorry, Scott.
That's all right. You just kind of skeeved me out.
I made it gross.
Skeeved me out.
Did you say skeeved
me out? I did, yeah. So you can go to one of, looks like four different places here. It's mentioned on the website. So you can go to harleydavidson.com and find all this information. But you can go to York, Pennsylvania, Kansas City, Missouri, Tomahawk, Wisconsin, or the last one I'm going to have trouble with, but Menominee, Wisconsin. And you can, I don't know, watch Harley-Davidson's being built. I actually, you know, a lot of them are like, you know, one is the powertrain operations. The other one is vehicle and powertrain operations. Mm-hmm. You can see different things happen at different places, different models being made. But they still have their world headquarters, their corporate headquarters, which is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And that is located in, let's see, Juneau Avenue in Milwaukee. And it's also the site of the original Harley-Davidson family home, which is, you know, where the shed was in 1903.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
That's the site of it. So, I thought it was kind of interesting. A little follow up on, you know, their location in the world here and some of the history that goes along with that. So, you know,
yeah,
big American company, a lot of history to it. I know we've just kind of glazed over a lot of facts, you know, within that, but you know, you can tell we're already going long with this podcast. There's so much more out there.
There is so much more out there, and we will be remiss if we don't mention the aftermarket too. While you're on the Harley-Davidson website, checking out the factory tour opportunities. Also take some time to check out the descriptions of the models, the spec sheets. They've got a little payment calculator, which is pretty common now on a lot of vehicle websites. So you can see how you can make this dream happen.
Yeah, Ben, I'm not going to lie to you. These are kind of expensive bikes. The new bikes, pretty pricey. They're right up there with like a family sedan cost.
I know, man. That's, you know, I'm cheap, bro. That's why I get glazed over.
Yeah, get a used one.
Get a used one because the market for these customizations after you have the bike is huge. You can do almost anything with
it. Enormous. And that points right to what Chad had mentioned earlier. Yeah. Chad from Kansas said that, you know, take a look around when you're in traffic or wherever you happen to be. You'll notice that you're not going to find two Harleys that are the same. Mm-hmm. And that's because of this massive aftermarket customization that happens just about in every case.
And now that we've brought Chad Roadkill back, we hope that you guys all enjoyed this. Chad, we hope we did right by you.
Yeah, we hope you got a little something out of it. I know he probably knows a lot more than we do about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just kind of an intro, a primer to the Harley-Davidson history. Really.
101. Mm-hmm. And thus ends our 101 podcast. Guys, we hope you enjoyed listening to this as much as we enjoyed doing it. We'd love to hear from you if you are for or against motorcycles and why. Hit us up on Facebook, find us on Twitter, check out our blog. You can read these articles in depth on howstuffworks.com. And it doesn't have to be about Harleys. If you want us to do something else, just send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.